tonight, huh? Old Bill, come on, you.
Good afternoon and good morning and good evening and welcome to listening to this. I know you're probably not listening to it on the road or on your journey to work, but
we don't know what time of day it is, man.
We don't have any idea what time of day it is for you. Folks, you are listening to the Drunken UX Podcast, and I am your host, Michael Feenan.
I'm your other host, COVID-19. I mean, Aaron Hill.
This week on the Drunken UX Podcast, this is episode number 61, and we are talking about creating efficient emergency websites. And we are going to be talking emergencies more in the sense of like something that could take your site down, kind of situation, sort of DRP, disaster recovery type stuff.
Any kind of situation where you're suddenly going to have a surge of traffic.
Right.
And a lot of people, like the Department of Labor in New York State, for example.
Yeah, every single unemployment site in the nation right now. Or
yep.
We've used the phrases before, you know, the slash dot effect or the hug of death.
Yeah.
The Reddit hug of death. Let's see. But before we do that, I do want to encourage you to check us out on Twitter or Facebook. That is @drunkenUX or on Instagram @drunkenUXpodcast. I got some fresh memeage getting ready to come to you on Instagram. Oh my God, you're going to be head over heels, Aaron.
Oh, I'm excited.
I've worked real hard on curating this next batch. Also, if you want to chat with us, make sure to go by drunkenux.com/Discord, and you can jump into our Discord channel with us. We have moved from Slack to Discord. If you use the old link from an old show, that will still work. It will just send you to Discord instead of Slack, so don't be confused if you're expecting one over the other. What have you got for your imbibement this evening?
I've got some mezcal from Nuestra Soledad. It's from Oaxaca. It is it's good. It's like well, if you drink it neat, it has a smoky flavor. Yeah. It's a little bit. It tastes like if you can imagine scotch made from agave, which is right. I guess literally what it is. But it's. It's really good. Tonight I put a big rock on the glass and a quarter of a lime, and that gave it a very different bit of flavor to it.
Pretty otherwise good. Straight, basically.
Yeah. I wouldn't mix this. This is I wouldn't mix this any sooner than I would mix Coke with Scotch. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, that's fair.
Yeah.
How long do they age that?
It doesn't say how many years.
Mezcal in general, I think it's. Is it 3 years? I genuinely don't know off the top of my head. I think there is like a window that they do it though.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, but it's from Oaxaca though. It's legit stuff. What do you got?
I am drinking something very different for me, actually. It's a High West Distillery Burr Rye.
Like a mixture of bourbon and rye?
Yeah, it's a bourbon rye straight whiskey blend. It comes out of a distillery in Park City, Utah. So it's not necessarily easy to find. The bottle is beautiful. The bottle is sort of this very, very light blue, and it's got that
show me.
I don't know if you can really see it through the webcam, but it's got that sort of old, you see the bubbly
glass? Yeah.
It's got that sort of old style glass look to it, like an old medicine bottle kind of. It's a very rough looking glass to eyeball it. This is strong shit. It's bottled at 46%, which is not planetary, you know, setting records right. or anything, but it is strong. It is quite sweet for a whiskey. It's honey kind of on the nose and palate. It hits with a little bit of like, have you ever had like bourbon ice cream, like a vanilla ice cream that's flavored with bourbon?
No, but I want to now.
Yeah, it's got that kind of like you can really taste like this sort of ice creamy sort of vanilla flavor coming in, but that bourbon tone carries through it like very very heavily and finishes a little bit spicy, not necessarily a black pepper, but maybe like a white pepper kind of finish on it. But very strong. Like this is a whiskey that you take a sip of and it's like hello. It lets you know it's there. But it's not like super burny. It doesn't give you that hot chest feeling that especially a rye bourbon can do for you, or a rye whiskey can do for you. It's flavorful. It's something like this would be great with a giant porterhouse steak.
Okay.
That is what this, I would love to sit here with a giant plate of grilled meat and eat with this.
Ron Swanson.
Thanks to my friend Rory. He brought this over last time he visited, and I've had it on my shelf, and I've been delicate drinking it because I don't want to run out of it too fast, but tonight I wanted something a little different, so here we are. What more can I say?
I saw, this is sort of related to that, I recently saw this video on the Epicurious YouTube channel about how to make every classic cocktail. So like every cocktail from the late 1900s, early 20th century, you know, Tom Collins, Martini, Manhattan, Old Fashioned, all those. It's like 40-something minutes long, but it was so cool. I'll have to send you a link to it. It was really awesome. I want to try all those drinks. They look delicious.
Well, that'll get us through about episode 242, so that's a good plan. Folks, I want to give a shout-out to everybody over at Smashing Magazine, and that should come as no shock because everything Smashing Magazine puts out is fantastic. If they're not on your reading list, they should be already. And so you may have already heard about this. And this came up a while back, and I just didn't have time to fit it into a show until now. But back in March, they finally released the Ethical Design Handbook. This is the latest in their series of Smashing books. I think they've had four, if my memory is right, up until now. And this is one that... the way they describe it on their book release post is they say, what happens when ad blockers, cross-browser tracking protection, and data regulation like GDPR and CCPA become a norm too? That's when an honest, ethical design could be a competitive advantage. This is something that's super interesting to me because I work at a company where GDPR factors into everything we do. CCPA is factoring into everything we do. We try to do right, you know, our cookie compliance, you know, we got a cookie compliance banner, and we've been very aware of not trying to build those things in a way meant to trick people into confirming, you know, acceptance with us.
Right.
And so this rings really true to me as far as like what I find important as a developer and designer. So I'm really excited about sitting down with this. I haven't started reading it yet, but I'm super stoked to get into it.
Yeah. I had considered that it might be a competitive advantage. That's interesting.
Well, you know, it's a trust thing, right? This is where you go from UX to CX, customer experience. Right. And, you know, that idea of building trust with your customers and giving them the right experience, not just with your application, but just as a human being kind of thing.
People know when they're being snowed over like that, and it's shitty. I don't know. Like why would you want your brand to be associated with a negative experience like that? Or something annoying.
And the easy one, right, is how many times do you go to sites and they're like, hey, we use cookies to do stuff and we just need to know if you will let us do it. And your only option is to accept.
Right.
Like they modal their site and it's like, you can't dismiss it. You have to click accept or go away.
Right.
And I go away. There is no site that does that I need that badly. I will go to another site and find the information.
You know what I hate is when they do it, pop up a modal and it's a call to action or some kind of like lead gen or something. And it's like, hey, do you want to find out these 12 secrets of your privacy or whatever? And then it's either like, yes, or no, I don't care about this, or no, I have all the answers already, or something that's like you know it's the option you want to click on, but they try to make you feel shitty for clicking on it.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if that's specifically an ethical design issue, but like, you know, fuck you, man.
It sucks because I know doing it right is hard. I know how much time we have spent on our tools and are still spending on making it so that users have, you know, full granular control over, well, I'll accept your, you know, your tracking cookies, but I don't want your marketing cookies or something like that.
Right. I still always go back to CGP Gray's mailing list. He has on every one of his emails from his mailing list, at the right at the top of the email, it says, and I'm quoting literally, big obvious unsubscribe link here. Boom, right at the top. Never clicked it. I've never wanted to, because I like the emails that I get from him, because he sends quality email. Every other email that I get from anyone else, it always has it like buried at the bottom, or it's obscured, or
I'm gonna throw a call back to something that we talked about briefly last episode, I believe.
Sure.
That, you know, in giving somebody the option to decline something or to opt out of something is not going to entice them to make the negative action, right? Like providing the option is not going to, they're not going to see that and be like, oh yeah, I'm just not going to do that. It's, you know, and like you say, it's like with the emails. If you're getting the email and you like the email, you're not going to unsubscribe from it. The only time you're going to unsubscribe from it is when you don't want it anymore. And if you don't make that easy, you're going to draw the ire of certain users who may shame you publicly over it.
I don't know who that could be.
I don't have any idea who I could be referring to on that, but that's the only time where that really is a problem, is you're making it harder for the user to do what the user wants to do, regardless of how you want it to happen as a business.
It's like, okay, make a good product, people won't want to leave.
Yeah, it reminds me, I think if we do a throwback here to episode 41, Ron Bronson was on with us, and we talked about hostile design.
Yes.
We got into some of this, and it leads into that, right? The ethics of design and what is right to do and things like that. So that's a good episode to go back and listen to if you want to get a little bit of background on that. If you're interested in the book, we'll have a link in the show notes. You can go check it out. This isn't a sponsored mention. We're not getting any kind of kickback whatsoever on plugging this. It's $19 for the ebook. It's $39 if you want the ebook and the print version.
Nice.
I put my money where my mouth is. I bought it. I just haven't started reading it yet. But as soon as I get through it, you can bet you'll be hearing about it on a future episode of the Drunken UX Podcast.
Nice. I got to check that one out.
So this week we want to take a little bit of time here, and by a little bit, I mean roughly exactly 34 minutes or so, to talk about emergency sites. When I say an emergency site, I mean like a site that needs to be put up in a hurry that is designed to convey necessary information to an audience in high demand.
Here's some scenarios. There's a school closing. Or there's a big snowstorm, everyone wants to know if school's closed. Or there's an active shooter situation on your campus and or business place. Or there's an earthquake or a tornado or something similar, and everyone wants to know, you know, where they get supplies or where to go for emergency.
Or not to go.
Right, yeah. Just any kind of situation where there's communication that has to happen and people know to go to your place for information, so everyone's going to go there all at once.
I'll throw an even stupider one in there, and that's hardware failure.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, and like you and I think, have probably lived through a version of all of these at some point. I was heavily involved right after the tornado hit Joplin.
Okay. Missouri, right?
Yeah, Joplin, Missouri. Yeah. That was 2011, I believe.
Yes.
I had just had a knee surgery, and I was stuck in my recliner, and I used to be a firefighter years and years ago, and I've kind of got this, I still got that mentality of when something bad happens, my instinct is to jump up and go, you know, do something, and I couldn't then. I was stuck in my chair, so what I ended up doing was helping coordinate a lot of online resources and you know, relaying information to people. Keep in mind, this was 9 years ago. We didn't have a lot of the tools that we have now.
Yeah.
It impacted cellular availability because towers were damaged and people were heavily using their phones and overloading them. Landlines were knocked out. You had power outages everywhere.
You know what? Do you remember Parks and Rec, the show?
Yes. Yeah.
So my daughter and I have been watching that recently, and we just got we watched the episode where they have the emergency response thing the day of her gala or something for some park. The simulation, it's a simulation of the city's like management for dealing with an emergency. And they talk about like, oh, well, you can't use your cell phones right now because everyone's using them and it's like overloading the cell phone towers. So like that sort of thing. Like it's emergency situations are going to create all kinds of things you may not be expecting.
Yeah. From an emergency standpoint, I remember when the Virginia Tech shooting happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe at High EdWeb one year, they even did a presentation on the impact that had on their website, like immediately after and in the days that followed, because they were getting a ton of traffic, not related to students and school and education, but just, you know, it's the digital rubberneck mentality. Like people are going there, they want to know what's going on or whatever. And all of that traffic, the whole kind of underpinning of all this is if your infrastructure cannot handle getting information out, what can you do to make sure that you can still get out that critical need to know information in a timely manner? This isn't full DRP. DRP is disaster recovery plans. We're not going to talk about, you know, co-location and offsite backups and things like you know, the super high end. This is more about just how do you keep the lights on for a website? And it's pretty easy in relative terms. It just takes somebody taking the time to sit down and make sure that those, you know, life jackets are stowed on the boat, so to speak.
Right.
Metaphor for those of you. So I want to reference, first and foremost, I have to give a shout out, and I'm going to apologize in advance because you know it's coming. It's a name that I'm having trouble with, and Aaron has tried to educate me on this. Max Book?
That's pretty close, I believe, yeah.
It's an umlaut O.
Yeah, O with the umlaut, DK.
I'm Kansas. We had a great laugh at me earlier today because I had to read some French text at work, and... There is no time I sound like I am more from Kansas than listening to me try to read French, because I don't speak French at all.
Je suis le fromage.
Je suis la chumfie. That's the only thing I know, and I am pretty sure it means I am a little girl. It's from one of those commercials where it's like the speak and say language tapes that you used to be able to buy. And the girl points to herself with a big thumb. She's like, this should be La Chumfie. There's a little trivia about me. So this is over at his blog, mxb.dev. Of course, we'll have a link in the show notes. But he wrote a blog post about a tool he's developed called the Emergency Website Kit. And it's made the rounds in a few places. It's a very cool tool that he's built, and we'll talk about it specifically here in a few. But
yeah, this is pretty cool.
It was inspired, or I don't know what the tool was, but his post was inspired by a comment from Nicholas Zakas on Twitter that said, "Just received a shelter-in-place emergency alert with a web address for more information. Click the link. The site is down. All emergency sites should be static." And it rings true right now, right? Because we are trying to push out a lot of emergency information to people, be it what are the shelter-in-place orders, what are the business rules right now for people, what do you do if you've been laid off from your job? And that's a big one, right?
Yeah.
We joked about it, but emergency sites unemployment sites across the nation are crippled right now because they can't keep up with demand. And it's taking down not just the application side of many of those sites, but also the front end where the FAQs are or phone numbers are. And that's a good example of why these things are important.
So to clarify, when we say static site, we mean like taking an HTML document from the file server or file system and then like punting it out to the request. So you request a page, they grab the HTML document fully formed and then swap it off to you. No pre-processing. So like if it goes through PHP, if there's any PHP in it, for example, that's going through a preprocessor, which is going to require more memory, more resources. And then as you scale up your requests, like that's going to put a bigger load on the server. If you have a framework like .NET, Rails, etc., or even WordPress, like every request is going to be a huge, huge chunk on each of those.
Right. And that's what I was going to say, is WordPress being the classic example. Most folks are familiar with it. Yes, you can run caching on WordPress. That will help things. But generally speaking, WordPress works by rendering every page on the fly. Yeah. And this gets into where, if we segue into talking about capacity, server capacity, the reason the site goes down is because it has limited resources. It only has so much CPU and so much memory. And the more people hitting a server, the more of that is in use. And when it gets to its limit, it can no longer effectively get pages out in a timely manner, and you get server errors. Those may be 500 errors. Those may be just a straight up, you know, server down error.
503 service unavailable. Yeah.
The in WordPress, a session, and this can be highly variable because it depends on your theme, it depends on your plugins, it depends on a lot of stuff. But WordPress on average uses about 15 to 40 megabytes of RAM per session. Because of the PHP thread and the overhead that WordPress is running to make the database calls, and
you have to create an in-memory object for the database handler,
right? And that's something else. And when we talk about this, is your HTTP server has to use memory, your PHP thread is using memory, your database is using memory, and each one of those has limits. There are bottlenecks that, as a result, estimating your server capacity is incredibly hard.
Yeah.
And there isn't a real simple equation to use to be like, well, this is how much RAM and CPU I have. How many sites or how many people can I serve every minute? Well, it depends. It depends on a lot of stuff. There is, for what it's worth, sort of an abstract equation. And again, it will be linked in the show notes. It's from ServBolt. And the way they describe it, if you take the number of CPU cores divided by the average page response time in seconds, which is something you can get from your Chrome Inspector tools or whatever, times 60 for 60 seconds, times user click frequency, which you can get from Google Analytics, that gives you the maximum simultaneous users.
Huh.
In the sense of, you know, considering a person on your site, not just how many pages you can spit out, but how many individual people can use your website over the course of a session at once.
When you have your website and you have your content being served up through WordPress or some sort of framework, we lean on these frameworks because it makes adding new things that require user interaction a lot more easy. But in these emergency situations, all people need is one-way communication. They just need to know, you know, what's going on, what's the latest status of this thing, what do I do, how can it be safe, etc. Who can I contact if I have a problem? That sort of thing. It's just, they just want an answer. And you can give them all those answers statically, so without using any of the framework or anything else. And so you don't have to use all this extra bloat that you might have with a framework, when all you need is just to be able to serve up that content.
Yeah. For what it's worth, if you really want to know what it takes to take your server down, try to take your server down. There are tools to help with that. And my personal favorite is a tool called Siege. It's a command line tool, so you do have to get a little familiar with. If you aren't good at using the command line, you will want to. But there'll be a link to that. There's also Apache JMeter or Apache Bench. Any one of those, you can download their free tools. You set up the pages that you want to hit. You can give it, you know, just your home page, or you can give it a list of pages. How many clients you want to generate, how many visits per second you want to generate. And basically, you just start turning up the dial. And like when you finish with Siege, it gives you a report of how many connections were dropped and how many pages were dropped. And you just start slowly, you know, you start with 10 users requesting a page a second. And it comes back and it says, we had 100% hit rate. So dial it up, turn that knob up to 2, turn it up to 5, and start seeing where things start falling apart. That's the best way, really, to figure out where your server will fail, because how much RAM, how much CPU usage and stuff you have is great, but you may have other services running on those boxes. If your database server is on a different box from your production server, like all of this kind of stuff will affect how much load you can take.
Right.
So a tool like that lets you, I mean, it's what you're basically doing with Siege is running a DDS, denial of service attack, a DOS, sorry, attack.
Before you do that to your server, you may want to let your, like if you're hosting through DigitalOcean or someone, maybe you should let them know first.
It is generally a good rule of thumb that unless it's like hardware you own.
Yeah.
Definitely alert, like, and WordPress Engine, I know, you definitely want to let them know you're doing that. They will let you do it. They have no problem letting you do it. But if you don't tell them in advance, they assume it's an attack and they will block whatever is coming in. So that is, something definitely to keep in mind. But any of those tools will at least, those will actually give you the performance of your server then. And do it when it's not live, ideally. That's maybe the other piece of advice. But once you know that, you'll have kind of this thumbprint, this fingerprint of how good are you? That's why it's important to know that.
I'm going to throw back to episode 22 where we discussed healthcare.gov. That wasn't an emergency situation, but they definitely didn't consider the load that the site would have to be able to take.
Yeah. Well, even the IRS site with the Get My Payment tool the other day.
Yeah.
When it first launched. And at least now it looks like they have provisioned it so it will stay up.
Yeah.
To say the least. The next part of this is then it gets into DNS. Not going to go real deep into this, but I want to mention a couple things because DNS may or may not be in your control as a designer, as a developer, but maybe you're an army of one at a company, so this is all something you handle. It just depends. But DNS gets into the sort of DevOps realm of being able to make sure the traffic is going to the right place. Yeah. So normally, you have a DNS record. That DNS record says, mysite.com is at IP 127.0.0.1.
Mm-hmm.
That's your A record. And if that site goes down, normally people keep going to this dead site. They type in your address, they're told where to go, and they go there, and it's another hit on a server that's all your, stop kicking him, he's already dead, kind of thing. So there's a couple things you can do here. One is, and probably the best idea is to use a load balancer.
Mm-hmm.
I can't give you great advice on this because every load balancer is a little bit different. But
why don't you describe what a load balancer does first?
Yeah, sure. A load balancer is basically the only thing it does. It's a simple tool that just says, hey, you want access to this stuff. Here's where I'm going to send you. And so when you have a big site, like let's say it's Amazon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Amazon isn't running their website on one old white box Dell stuffed in somebody's closet.
Wait, they're not?
No. I guarantee you that is not the way they do it.
It's
they
an were HP computer. Folks. Yeah, that's right.
Right on the same page with you. They, you know, it's across thousands of servers.
Right.
What the load balancer does is, it's like a queue manager almost, right? It's like you go to the airport and they've got four security lanes.
I was going to say, Trader Joe's. Have you ever been there?
I have never been there.
The checkout line is one long line, and then there's a person standing at the head of the line, and then as each register becomes open, they direct you to that register.
Bank teller?
Yeah.
Bank teller, and I was saying,
oh, yeah, that's
TSA.
A great idea.
You're going through security at the airport. You go up to the single guy who's like checking your deal, but then they're like, okay, go down to line 8 or whatever.
Right.
That's what a load balancer does. It's trying to distribute traffic amongst a bunch of servers, usually keep load down. Now, that's a first line of defense. If you need to handle a lot of traffic, scale yourself horizontally, have your site on 3 servers. Then you can handle triple the weight. That's not feasible for most folks, and it's not necessary for a lot of folks, though.
With AWS, I had a class on a short seminar class on this. Setting up a load balancer in AWS is, I'm not going to say it's simple, but they make it as painless as possible. Yeah. I think
ELBs, they're very basic though. They don't have a lot of functionality.
Right, but you basically take your EC2 instance and then you say, okay, prop up 2 of these, stick a load balancer in between them, and then it splits the traffic.
Right. What you really want to look at, though, is how your pools are configured. Are you balancing or are you setting up failover? And this is where a load balancer becomes very valuable. Normally, if you're running a load balancer and you're balancing between 2 servers and server 1 goes down, the load balancer is constantly checking the health of that server and it goes, oh no, server 1 went down. We'll start sending people to server 2.
Right.
That's where people like me get really nervous and say, God, I hope I have enough resources on server 2 to take that load.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing it can do is you could have a 3rd server that's the backup that never gets traffic to it at any other time.
Right.
But you could say, if server one fails, then start sending traffic to server three instead.
I've never actually tried this, so I don't know if this would work. But when you have multiple, like when you have your DNS records that say like, okay, use this IP address, and if this one fails, use this one, and so on. Couldn't you have like your, you know, the main site be the first one, and then your very simple emergency site be the failover?
Right. Like if, yeah, and that's exactly the point. With if yeah. you set up your load balancer to have that failover, ideally what happens is, because here's the thing, right? If you manage your DNS manually and a site goes down, yeah. you have to go into your DNS zone file and change that record to point to a new IP address.
Right.
Which is all well and good unless you have like a 24-hour TTL, time to live setting set. But if you've got that high setting, though, if your DNS record is set to 24 hours and you change that IP address, you have no guarantee that people are going to get your emergency site for the next day in some cases. Usually it is definitely faster than that, but you have no guarantee of that. On a load balancer, that's not true. As long as that load balancer is up, it is still a load balancer is still a single point of failure. That's granted. But you say, here's you know, the pool for our production sites. Here's the pool for our emergency site. If production goes down, your only job is to then say, okay, now we're sending all the traffic to this new IP. And nobody has to wait on anything.
I think there's a softer solution. We had when I worked at Indiana University many, many years ago, we put a little snippet in the top of our like main template, and if there was ever any kind of emergency from central IU, like central communication, it would be embedded into that thing dynamically when the page was loaded. The advantage here is that this is a really simple thing to add, and it gives people immediate information that that's clearly visible when they first load the page up, so they don't have to look anywhere. The downside is that it doesn't, like, you're still having to load up everything, and if you get a massive deluge of traffic coming in, like, you're going to get taken down still. But this at least prevents people having to click around the site.
So the other thing you can do on DNS that can make this a little simpler, if load balancers aren't your cup of tea, or you just don't have the ability or the money or the wherewithal, there are services that can do like dynamic DNS monitoring for you. That they usually cost a few bucks or so. One that comes to mind that I know of, I haven't used it, so I can't really speak to like from an experience standpoint, but I know DNS Made Easy does this. You obviously have to let them manage your DNS, but then you give them your primary IP address and then like your failover IP address. And so if they work just like a load balancer in that sense, and that if they detect your main IP go down, they will start routing people to your backup IP address. Then you don't have to concern yourself with it or worry about that at all. It'll just be there, basically. I'll throw a link to it. They've got a little article that explains how their stuff works. Something to keep in mind, if you want to run a separate emergency site, you have to be concerned about DNS.
This is perhaps a little in the weeds and requires some knowledge of server maintenance, but another thing you could do is have a separate document route for a low bandwidth site on your server, and then if you know you're going to be hitting a spike or you're in an emergency situation or something like that, go into your web server, Apache, Nginx, whatever, and then tell it to tell it to point to the alternate, restart the server, and then it should just work.
Right.
I'm not going to say that's simple. It's a relatively small thing to do if you're familiar with doing it.
Yeah. And it depends on what your emergency strategy is, too. Like, how you plan to update that, how, you know, information will get out through it, and how you're tooled, how your CMS works. All of this has to factor in. Use one thing, if you've got an emergency site, you can also use a CDN in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
This helps in a couple ways. One, you're relying on people who spend way more money on delivery infrastructure than what you do. You're not going to spend more than CloudFront or DigitalOcean or Cloudflare or any of these folks. So by relying on their infrastructure to deliver pages, even if it's your normal site, you're offloading a ton of server load to the CDN.
Yeah.
They don't ever have to hit your server to get your page. The CDN will cache it and deliver it from there. And so you still, they still get the information, but you've now enabled yourself to make sure your server stays up. The caveat being, if you use one of these services, especially CloudFront, CloudFront's an AWS service, it's metered, so it charges you based on how much you use. If you are experiencing an extremely high spike in traffic due to an event, you want to make sure you're keeping your bandwidth usage low so you aren't also slapped with a giant bill to go along with all the headache of having a site down. That's just something to consider. Some services like DigitalOcean, you're paying a flat fee for access to their CDN up to, I forget what it is, I think a terabyte or something of delivery. So odds are, okay, especially if you've got a low bandwidth site, you're not going to hit their limit, most likely. That's a ton of traffic at that point. So let's talk about emergency sites and a couple tools that are out there. There's one that is newer, and I don't know if it came out as an exact response to COVID-19, but I know that's where it's getting pushed real heavily. That's servicerelief.us. It's a site that's designed to use Airtables and Netlify to push out a very simple static site that has all its content editing basically in a spreadsheet for people. So putting information into it is easy. And it generates a super light, very tiny site that runs through Netlify's system then. It's simple. It's not going to meet everybody's needs, but it's a good place to start if this is something you're interested in and want to get a feel for what these things can look like.
Yeah.
It's a very straightforward system. The folks who are using it, you'll see, you know, they're putting out lists of things like which restaurants are open or where can you go to support them. Are there events or resources available to the community to assist with things? You know, food banks where they can pick up stuff. You know, Meals on Wheels type services and things like that. The other one is the one that Max set up and talked about in his article, which is the Emergency Site Kit. He's got this on GitHub, and there is a demo site. It's emergency-site.dev. If you want to go look at what it looks like in production, you can fork his repo and start changing stuff from there. He's got a lot of information about how it's set up. It also uses Netlify as its default distribution system. You can, in theory, connect it to any kind of front end or back end rather that you want. The output is really impressive, though. So he's using Eleventy. It's a static site generator. When you update your content in Netlify, Eleventy runs, generates the static content, and then pushes it into the file server. The main page for that emergency dev site is only 3.3 kilobytes.
It's amazing.
It's super tiny. It takes 5 requests, although only one of those is necessary. The other ones are like a couple fav icons and something else.
Mm-hmm.
The page itself loads in 1.47 seconds, and the HTML document takes a whopping 7 milliseconds to download. 7 milliseconds to download that main HTML document. And he's also done something very cool that, you know, he didn't have to do, but makes a lot of sense for people who need access to this information. He's included service workers. This is something we haven't really talked about on the show at all. And it's a new browser API tool that you can take advantage of to do work in the background on sites. And he's using an offline service worker. So once you visit the page, it's using a service worker to cache your website into local storage and serve it so that if for some reason something happened to even take the emergency site down, you still could access the information that you had access to before.
That's cool.
So, yeah, it acts kind of like a cached web server locally. So
wild. Wow, three kilobytes, though. That's
super awesome. Tiny. Yeah.
Just as a quick PSA, 3.5 kilobytes means you're probably not loading any images.
Absolutely.
Unless images are absolutely necessary for your part of your emergency response. For example, showing a map of this is where to go in the case of this thing or whatever. Don't put images. You don't need your branding. You don't need anything. Just use big fat text that people can read easily and keep it clean.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, that's a good point to just talk about how we should structure these kinds of things. So like when I was building mine, I tried to stick what are the essentials? If we have an emergency, what's the most important stuff people need access to? So A, the simpler you keep this thing, the more accessible it's going to be and the easier it's going to be for people to get what they need.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in a situation where, you know, cellular bandwidth is low or lines are out and, you know, you don't have time to download a site that may come in at 10 megabytes for all of the background videos and images and CSS and JavaScript and ads, it's not going to look pretty, but pretty is not the goal. Information is the goal. I would stick to news. I would stick to news that's going on, like what is pertinent right now. If it's like an active shooter type situation, what are the emergency phone lines to check on loved ones or to submit tips? What locations are safe or not safe? You know, that kind of news is going to be immediately important to everybody and should be the stuff at the top of that page.
Right. Think about if you had an actual emergency situation. You have an active shooter on campus or there's literally a fire. Literally nothing matters other than telling people, don't go to this place. It's dangerous and you might die.
Yeah. Social links, I think, in this day and age are top of the list important.
Oh, definitely.
Have a link to your Twitter, have a link to your Facebook, have a link to your YouTube. Three most important ones.
Oh, yeah.
They're guaranteed to be up.
Yeah.
And everybody will be able to access the information there because odds are your accounts aren't private. So,
right.
And if they are, they definitely shouldn't be during a crisis.
In an emergency situation, Twitter is perfect for that because you know they're like, they have so much redundancy on their servers and it's built for doing like status updates. And you can just, you know, put a link to the Twitter account and then let Twitter handle the rest of the requests.
Yeah.
So people just keep refreshing the Twitter page rather than refreshing your page.
That, yeah, exactly. The F5 effect, right? The reality is you're only making that problem worse when you're encouraging people to sit there and refresh a page over and over. You know, the pressure is not ever being let off. Contact information kind of goes along. And I mentioned, you know, what are the emergency phone numbers or email addresses or whatever. And in some cases, you may also want to have a link to your real site. The thing about an emergency site is, you know, your server may not be down, but you may be, you know, using it like a prophylactic to prevent it from going down.
Right.
You've got all of this traffic coming to your site that isn't interested in your products or your marketing campaign or signing up for your newsletter. They're coming there because something bad happened or
it's like that that example we talked about earlier with the little embed on your homepage. If your sudden uptick in traffic is because people just need an answer about something that everybody's going to have the same question about, real easy to satisfy that need without getting into everything else.
Yeah. And so like for, let's say, students, have the link in there that says, you know, access the student portal or whatever your top links are or something like that. And then that will go to the real site and you're filtering basically a lot of that, you know, a lot of that traffic then so that the load on your main site can drop down and you're serving the super lightweight page.
Flattening the curve, if you will.
Flattening the curve, yeah. So, and technically, strategically, and Aaron, you hit on this already, but to make this really effective, minimizing your external dependencies is like priority number one. So yeah, images are a no-no in my book. A lot of these tools, like the static site generators, 11T, that the emergency site kit uses, Jekyll Gatsby, they can take all your CSS, all your JavaScript, and inline it into that page so it's not a separate file. It's just included in the markup. That means you've reduced a request for each one of those files. One request now is handling everything.
Mm-hmm.
By not using images, you know, that 100 kilobyte screenshot has, you know, that's increased the size of your site by 33-fold if your site's only 3 kilobytes.
Yeah.
And here's a backup answer to that too. If you have to have an image like that, use another third-party service like Imgur or something.
Yeah.
And throw throw the images up there so that even if it has to be a separate request, it's not a request coming from your infrastructure.
This is like a really obvious thing, but like think about it, because every additional request that's coming from your server is essentially separate. So if you request a document and the document has six image references in it, that's six more requests you're hitting your server. That's seven total. Yeah. And so if you have 1,000 times the number of users you normally get, that's 7,000 extra requests that are coming through.
Yep.
So yeah, Imgur is a great idea.
And SVGs then, like you mentioned, you know, they factor in well because SVGs are incredibly tiny. Mm-hmm. They can be inlined into your CSS.
Yep.
Or they can be inlined into your HTML because they're just code. And they let you design, and I was actually really proud of the site that I had built at Pitt State because of that. Like, it certainly was not the most beautiful thing in the world because it was using system fonts and things like that, but it wasn't ugly. You can still do some layout with it. You can still put a little extra HTML in there to make it look nice and have it not just be a wall of text or something. And I'm just spitballing.
Yeah.
50 kilobytes would probably be where I would stop and say, think about what you're putting on that page.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I think that's a ceiling.
In an emergency situation, you absolutely do not need 50 kilobytes of data.
Yeah.
Like at that point, you should be directing them to a different source and just giving them the TLDR right up front.
Yeah. Let's talk quickly about static site generators because they factor in heavily to the emergency site kit. Talking about the way, so the emergency site kit uses Netlify.
Right.
The servicerelief.us site uses Netlify. You don't have to use Netlify as your backend. You could use WordPress as your backend. If you're comfortable with WordPress as an editing platform, you could use that and then tie in a static site generator that would make it so that you don't have to use WordPress to serve the pages.
Right.
I won't get into that. I'll find you a good tutorial, though, on Gatsby and WordPress and throw it in the show notes. But there is nothing that can beat static HTML from a performance standpoint.
No.
When you don't have databases involved, when you don't have JavaScript involved, when you don't have Node involved or any backend application stuff involved, just sending a browser a flat HTML page that has to do no other work.
All of the rendering is done on the client side. So. Yeah. I would say, in a pinch, if you, before you resolve the rest of these issues, you know, if you do have a sudden bandwidth spike, contact whoever your service provider is for your hosting provider, I mean, see if you can get them to temporarily bump your RAM up just for like the short term so they can handle the spike better. That's going to be probably your biggest, like just get in touch with them and let them know, we're having this problem right now. Like, can you please help us, you know, bill us later, but we only need it for this period.
Never hurts to ask. And if you're using a managed host, especially a lot of managed, like the white glove services, they will have no problem doing that.
Yeah.
That is why you're paying them. And that's, I think, an important emphasis to asterisk to spit on that. Spit? Why did I say spit?
But throwing RAM at the problem can absolutely, like you could still run into problems with it and you need to come up with a better solution. But in the meantime, though, it'll make it a little more accessible.
Yeah. If you're on shared hosting, obviously different situation, but So 11T is the static site generator that emergency site kit uses. The two that, that I'm more familiar with and you probably have heard are Jekyll and Gatsby.
Yeah. Was it episode 31, episode 31. That was with Dustin Hsiao, who works at Gatsby.
Jesus, you are better at this, remembering these things than I will ever be.
It's not from memory. I bring up the page and search for it.
Okay. But yeah, Gatsby is something that you're probably familiar with, at least the name. I'm sure most folks have probably heard that name thrown around at some point. But these tools, regardless of if you're using a framework like the Emergency Site Kit or if you're rolling your own, those can be incredibly useful for generating those sites and then pushing them, whether push them to S3 and then put CloudFront in front of it. Push them, if nothing else, GitHub has their pages tool, GitHub Pages.
Yeah.
And you can serve a website from GitHub Pages. All you need is to have it run the generation script. There are limitations to that, but I think for a lot of people, especially for an emergency site, you're probably safe on it. They have what they say is a soft bandwidth limit of 100 gigabytes per month. And while I keep talking, Aaron, divide that out. What is
I just did.
How many page views is that at 3.3 kilobytes of page?
30 million and change.
So, you're probably okay. And that's per month. And
if you have more than 30 million visitors, you probably can afford to do something bigger than GitHub pages.
True. The other thing is you can have 10 builds an hour. So if you imagine, that would be like having an update every 6 minutes.
Point to Twitter. If you're going to have updates more often than that, just point to your Twitter account. If you don't have one, go make one.
Absolutely. But yeah, you can look at that, and you can give GitHub Pages supports custom domain names and stuff like that. So if you wanted to give it a special domain name or anything, it can do that. The fact of the matter is, it doesn't take a lot of hardware to just send HTML to somebody. That's the other side of this coin, and you kind of mentioned that, Aaron, when you said, well, just change your document root.
Yeah.
I would argue that you probably don't want it on the same box, mm-hmm. but you could go get a server from 10 years ago, throw a couple extra sticks of old RAM in it, and just have that be your backup, and it probably would be effective at just running a server.
Static sites? Oh, yeah. Shit. Yeah. With Apache with static HTML, and that's all you're serving up? You don't need much hardware for that.
I can do you one better.
Yeah.
So the final thing we'll leave you with is if you are interested in squeezing every last drop of performance out of a machine, don't use Apache. Mm-hmm. I know everybody loves Apache. Most people love Apache or like Apache. They tolerate Apache. Nginx is better than Apache.
Yeah.
There's no way around. It's faster. It's leaner.
We use that in Rails a lot.
There's an article over at hostingadvice.com that compares Nginx and Apache, and their rough estimate was that in testing, Nginx was about 2.5 times faster than Apache at serving pages, which mm-hmm. means it can effectively serve 2.5 times as many page views as a consequence.
I've set up an Nginx server before. It's not significantly more difficult than setting up Apache.
It's not harder.
It is different, though.
It is different. One of the main reasons I think it hasn't caught on real well is because WordPress is still very Apache-centric.
Yeah.
You can run a WordPress on Nginx. It isn't easy, and it takes a lot of extra configuration to do it.
The LAMP stack, like Linux, Apache, MySQL, MariaDB, and PHP, it has been around for so long. People just, like, Apache does well enough. It's just easier to throw RAM at the problem than try to optimize with a different web server.
Server power has increased at a rate that it's like, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
If you want, at the end of the day, at the conclusion of all this discussion, like, if your goal is, hey, yeah, we should have an emergency site. I want it to be as bulletproof as possible. I know we may never mm-hmm. need it, but it's one of those things. You'd rather have it and not need it than need it and not have it.
Oh, yeah.
And I want it to be as good as it can be. I would go with nothing else beside Nginx. I would make sure we're using mm-hmm. a static site generator. Use whatever backend you want, whether that's WordPress, Netlify. Hell, you could use Drupal. You could use something like we've mentioned before, Hax, the Hax CMS. Yeah. I think they would love to see you use their platform.
I know you can technically do it, host your emergency site on WordPress or Drupal or whatever.
Medium.
But if you're going to go through the trouble of actually making a separate emergency site, just do static HTML. Like, there's really no reason not to. Anything that's coming from WordPress, I mean, if you need to have dynamic stuff getting pulled from your CMS or whatever, then set up a cron job to pull it down and copy it over or something, or just manually change it.
I would disagree with that on one basic ground.
Okay.
The person who is managing the content for your emergency site may not be technical enough to handle the HTML side.
Oh, okay.
And so having an authoring system, because that's the nice thing about stuff like Gatsby is it can integrate with GraphQL or the WordPress REST API. It's not about the experience or the serving. It's just all you're using it for is as a content store, as the authoring experience.
Oh, right. You were saying using WordPress or Drupal to manage the content.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Just the authoring experience, not the presentation.
I'm all right with that. Although be prepared, if your site's getting hosed, you may not be able to get in to author content.
Right. That's why it should be hosted somewhere else entirely.
Yeah.
So if you are doing static site generation and Gatsby is printing that out for you, that should be going to GitHub, or that should be going to a CDN, to S3 or something like that, to be served out from those locations, not served from the same place you're authoring from. Definitely.
When you're testing it, that should be part of your test plan, is like, what if I can't, what if I'm unable to get to my authoring platform? Or like, what if the main site is being hammered really hard? Will I still be able to produce content and do updates?
Yeah. To throw back to one of the earlier comments, the site relief.us framework, I mentioned that uses Airtables as its authoring platform.
Huh.
If you're not familiar with Airtables, it's basically like a freeform database it's kind of like an Excel sheet, basically, but as a database. It's got a very simple interface. It's meant to be very flexible. I don't know what it costs. I think they've got a free level and a couple paid tiers, but it's an entirely hosted solution.
Mm-hmm.
So it's designed to be there, you know, and not go down ever for any reason, because they're not concerned with having, you know, an emergency outage like that. It's a very creative approach. I don't like it only because I can see companies and having their, you know, their chief information officers or their PR people or whomever. Those folks aren't technical. They're going to be used to WordPress, most likely, or just whatever your CMS is. And so the more you can keep your experience in line with that, the more comfortable they will be using it, especially if you don't run fire drills, which maybe is the best closing thought for this episode. Make sure you run some fire drills with your emergency site once in a while so that these folks know how to use them, and make sure you know your DNS failover works properly and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at nucloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux. Everybody, thanks for sticking with us. This was episode number 61. I hope you found it useful. I hope it gave you some insights into thinking about an emergency website, how to keep it low bandwidth, and why you would want to keep it low bandwidth. I know we didn't dig real technical into how to set it up or how to wire the tools together. If you have questions about that, be sure to let us know. We would be absolutely happy to help and share any advice we've got from the sites we've managed.
Yeah, be sure to connect with us on Twitter, which you should have in case you're disaster plan and do things. We're on twitter.com/drunkenux and facebook.com/drunkenux, instagram.com/drunkenuxpodcast, and be sure to connect with us, even if you've connected with us before on Slack. Come and join us on Discord. The water is warm, things are nice.
It's because I peed in the pool.
Just avoid the general channel. it's drunkenux.com/Discord that will redirect you to the sign up page. If you go to /Slack, it'll just redirect you to Discord. So either way, you're going to come over there.
When if you dive into this stuff and you're trying to figure it out, know there are plenty of us out there who are willing to help and want to help. And it's something to think about. It's also a really good exercise if you aren't familiar with static site generators and want an excuse to kind of play with them and test them. Man, building an emergency site for your company or your organization is a great project that most likely won't get turned away, because it does have a great deal of value, and it's something that I think most people can show off and will be very pleased with. And, you know, outside of that, there's not really a whole lot else that we can give you except the advice that is most important during an emergency, which is to keep your personas close, but your users closer. Bye-bye.
See ya.